Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney. Coming up, Liberia's President Charles Taylor officially resigns, but vows, God willing, I will be back.
President Bush attends a barbecue with supporters who pledged to raise hundreds of thousands of dollars. Whatever happened to campaign finance reform?
Also, a paradox in the polls. Americans still generally like the president, but his approval rating is slipping.
What we find is that the American people are really not with him. He has a core of support, but what has thrust this presidency into the popularity that it has achieved has been 9-1-1 and then the war in Iraq.
These stories and cross-cultural reading suggestions coming up here and now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Liberia's President Charles Taylor has reluctantly resigned under pressure from the U.S. and handed over power to Vice President and longtime ally Moses Blah in a ceremony in Monrovia. Taylor arrived hours late wearing a white safari suit, and he repeated a remark that he made in his farewell address last night.
I leave you with these parting words. God willing, I will be back. God bless you.
Rebel leaders say the warfare in Liberia is over if Taylor leaves the country immediately. Taylor has been granted asylum in Nigeria. Rebel groups have rejected Taylor's handpicked successor, though. One of the African leaders present for the transfer of power says Blah will remain in office only until October, when he'll be replaced by an interim administration. More wildfires and power blackouts are being reported across Europe, which is in the grip of a severe heat wave. The hot weather is being blamed for more than 100 deaths so far. Suzanne Chislett reports from London.
The head of the French Emergency Doctors Association says dozens of people have died as a direct result of the heat in Paris over the last 4 days. Temperatures in the French capital reached 110 degrees Fahrenheit, and the nation's government is being criticized for classifying the deaths as natural. Ministers are holding emergency talks amid fears of power blackouts across France as power station water coolers battle to work in the rising external temperatures. Electricity supplies have already been cut in parts of Italy. New record data. Daily temperatures were set in Germany and Britain over the last few days. Over the weekend, London's Heathrow Airport passed 100 degrees for the first time. But as southern England continues to bask in hot weather, torrential rain and lightning storms have hit the north of the country. For NPR News, I'm Suzanne Chislett in London.
One U.S. soldier was killed and two wounded last night when a homemade bomb exploded in front of a police station they were guarding 45 miles north of Baghdad. British troops have restored electricity to parts of Basra and begun distributing gasoline there after 2 days of angry protests over energy shortages in the town. And U.S. forces in Iraq have launched a new operation using attack helicopters and tanks to round up insurgents loyal to deposed leader Saddam Hussein. The effort is being called Operation Ivy Lightning. California Governor Gray Davis says the move to recall him is an insult to the millions of voters who cast ballots for him last year.
Do I get upset over this? You better believe it. Trust me, I don't like this. But I am trying to suppress those negative feelings and channel my energies into doing something positive for the people I work for, the people of this great state.
Davis was interviewed on NBC's Today Show. Nearly 200 candidates have filed papers to run in the recall election. Wall Street, the Dow is down 31 points in light trading, and the Nasdaq Composite is up 9 points at 1653. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, stock prices are mixed on Wall Street. Technology shares benefited from bullish brokerage calls on software makers today, but analysts say little significant market movement is expected until the Federal Reserve's policymakers meet tomorrow and economic data is released later this week. Nearly 80,000 Verizon communications workers from Maine to Virginia are still working without a contract as negotiators try to hammer out a new agreement. Government mediators called a 3-day break on Friday. NPR's Trina Williams has more.
Verizon and its two unions return to the bargaining table tomorrow. Both sides say they've been moving forward since negotiations began early this month. Long and intense meetings got underway August 3rd after the strike deadline passed. Union negotiators decided to postpone a walkout because talks have been going so well. Communications Workers of America and the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers want to protect job security and health care benefits. Mike Harris is with one of the local CWA offices in Washington.
The fact that we don't want them to be able to transfer our jobs, as they say, anywhere in the world. They want the flexibility to be able to lay off people, and that doesn't set well with individuals that need their jobs.
The communications giant says it needs to slash expenses, maintaining that the company must create a more competitive cost structure. Trina Williams, NPR News, Washington.
Martha Stewart's retail and media firm has posted sharply lower quarterly profits, and shares of Martha Stewart Living OmniMedia are down 4% today. Stewart stepped down as chairman and CEO in June amid insider trading allegations. She's set to go on trial in January on charges of obstructing justice. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the N.E.E. Casey Foundation, supporting families and neighborhoods by funding initiatives aimed at helping disadvantaged children, on the web at aecf.org.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Liberian President Charles Taylor stepped down today. But what this step means for tormented Liberia remains unclear. Taylor spoke in Monrovia.
I want to praise God for all of you here today. I thank you. I thank the people of this great republic for all that you've done for me. I pray, God, that God will be with you.
Taking power from Taylor was his right-hand man, longtime colleague and crony, Vice President Moses Blah. Liberian rebels say they will oppose Blah just as they did Taylor. 14 years of civil war have left thousands dead in Liberia and more than a million homeless. Nicola Tano of the Christian Science Monitor was at the transition ceremony today and now joins us on the line. Welcome, Nicole.
Thank you.
Nicole, can you describe the scene at the handover?
Well, there were a few hundred people who attended, mostly dignitaries. Surprisingly, there weren't crowds of Liberians outside who were cheering or expressing their views. It was a rather quiet ceremony, all in all, and one where President Taylor really took his opportunity to say his last word. He rambled on for quite some time, but ultimately did hand over power to his vice president.
Now, significantly, as this was taking place, apparently something was happening in the harbor in Monrovia. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, just shortly after Mr. Taylor handed over power to his vice president, an American warship came into view for the first time. These ships have been off the shore. We've been told they've been off the shore for several weeks now, but this is the first time that we've actually seen them. I'm standing on a beach right now in Monrovia, and hundreds of Liberians have gathered to watch the ship, to cheer it, and really to see, for them, this ship is really a sign that better days are coming.
Better days are coming. Are people there anticipating that U.S. peacekeepers will then be on the ground in Monrovia sooner rather than later?
I think they're hoping they are. They were very excited when the Nigerian peacekeepers came last week. They cheered and went out in the tens of thousands to greet them. But at the same time, there is a certain distrust of Nigerian peacekeepers because of the experience that they had last time they were here more than 5 years ago. So I think that the community here really wanted the international community, particularly America, to play an important role in the transition, in the bringing of peace to Liberia.
Now, with these U.S. warships in the harbor, we must also ask about the man who's now taken power, at least temporarily, possibly pending elections in Monrovia, Moses Blah. What can you tell us about him?
Well, we don't know all that much about him, other than, as you said, he is a right-hand man of Mr. Taylor. He trained with him in Libya. He fought with him from the very beginning of when Taylor was a warlord and a rebel himself. He hasn't been very outspoken about how he plans to use the presidency, though he has said he will work with the rebels both in and outside the country. And hopefully, people are hoping that he will hand over power on October 2nd when the new transitional government is expected to take over.
Well, Nicole, has there been any word from the rebels as to how they're going to behave in the next days and weeks and months?
No, we haven't heard from the rebels yet, though we did hear warnings later yesterday and earlier today that if Mr. Taylor didn't leave the country after stepping down, that they would resume military action. What we have been told is that the American ambassador and ECOWAS, West African negotiators, will be going over to rebel territory later today to hopefully negotiate a ceasefire, to hopefully negotiate a treaty that will allow peacekeepers to deploy in rebel-held territory and give humanitarian organizations access to the port.
Yet just last week and the week before that, apparently, at the Monrovia airport, a Boeing 707 had landed with arms shipments for the government, yes?
Yes, and this is something that has worried a lot of people here. They've feared that Mr. Taylor or Mr. Taylor's successors, the people who are left behind when he leaves, would again take up arms. But we haven't really seen any sign of that. It does seem to be going very smoothly here today, I think far smoother than anyone expected.
These weapons, however, just to stick with that theme for just a moment, were from Libya?
That's what we have been told. That hasn't been confirmed to me personally, but the Washington Post did report that several days ago, and I think that their sources on that were quite sound. But Mr. Taylor does have a long relationship with Libyan President Muammar Gaddafi. He trained in Libya, and so it's no surprise, really, that Libya would be supplying these weapons to Taylor, who is under a United Nations arms embargo.
Charles Taylor now goes on to Nigeria, correct?
Yes, that is the plan. We've been told that hopefully the plan is that he will leave today with President John Kufuor of Ghana and the president of Mozambique, who is also the president of the African Union, that they will fly in a Nigerian jet to Abuja, the capital of Nigeria, later today.
Just very briefly then, in the 20 seconds or so we have left, Nicole, the mood there.
I think the mood is hopeful. It's been getting increasingly hopeful over the past few days since Nigerian peacekeepers arrived. But I think today, for the first time, people really feel like...
I think we have just lost Nicole Itano, but we were speaking with Nicole Itano in Monrovia, the Liberian capital. She's covering Liberia for the Christian Science Monitor.
Several pioneers and 18 rangers met at a home on the range this past weekend to be congratulated for their fundraising efforts on behalf of President Bush. The president attended the barbecue at a neighbor's ranch in Texas with 350 supporters. Some of them, called pioneers and rangers, have pledged fundraising goals of $100,000 and $200,000 each towards the $170 million Bush plans to raise for next year's reelection bid. Meanwhile, Democrats have unveiled a new organization called America Coming Together, which they hope will spend $70 million to counteract the Bush fundraising machine. And Democratic candidate Howard Dean caused a stir when his online challenge took in $200,000 more than an actual Dick Cheney fundraising dinner. It's a year away, and according to the Wall Street Journal, the presidential campaign is on track to be the most expensive in history. So, whatever happened to campaign finance reform? Massachusetts Congressman Marty Meehan was on the line. He co-sponsored a campaign finance reform law, and we welcome you, Congressman.
Delighted to join you, Robin.
Your law and another, the McCain-Feingold Act, aim to ban soft or unregulated money from being used by political parties to tell people who to vote for. In other words, an ad for a candidate. Well, right. I don't see a lot of ads yet in this primary run, but we do see a lot of money. What has happened?
Well, first of all, one of the good things is that neither party is raising unlimited soft money. That is from corporations and wealthy individuals. The limit is $4,000, $2,000 for primary, $2,000 for general. So there are no million-dollar checks being written by wealthy individuals. That's the good news. The bad news is that the presidential public financing system is broken, and it needs to be fixed. President Bush is on record. He's going to break all kinds of fundraising records, as he did 4 years ago. He doesn't participate in the publicly financed part in the primary, so he's going to raise $200 million in the primary. So what we need to do is make sure that the presidential public financing system allows a candidate who accepts contribution limits and spending limits to be able to be competitive. And I think under the present system, candidates will not be competitive.
Well, you've raised a couple of thoughts there. Let's address first the idea that the system may be broken. Some critics say that your law might have been a part of that and that it raised the amount an individual could give to that $2,000 you mentioned in the primary. At the time, critics said that that would hurt Democrats because, in effect, it limits what unions, for instance, large organizations can donate, as you mentioned, but it also favors Republicans who can collect more of those individual checks, which they seem to be doing. So was that criticism correct?
Well, first of all, I didn't support increasing the limit. I would have preferred to keep the limit down. But if you study the members of the United States Senate, members of the House, and see who has raised the higher dollar contributions, both Democrats and Republicans equally raised money in the $2,000 limit bracket. So I don't view this as negatively impacting one party or the other. The reality is when we passed campaign finance reform, the leadership of both political parties were against it. And now that soft money is made illegal, I hear both political parties saying, oh, we really would be better off if we were able to raise soft money. The fact is it had a corrupting influence over the way business was conducted in Washington. Now, on the issue of the presidential system, which is separate, in a presidential system, since the Watergate scandal in 1974, we've had a voluntary publicly financed system where candidates have agreed to spending limits. 4 years ago, George W. Bush did not participate in the publicly financed system. He didn't agree to spending limits in the primaries, and he raised $100 million. This year, it looks as if he's on a pace to break his record and raise $200 million. What it means is that the presidential financing system is broken, and we need to provide more public financing so candidates can compete with the amount of money that the president is putting into the campaign.
Well, Congressman, we should say that in 2000, candidate Bush rejected the public funding, he said, because he was facing millionaire Steve Forbes, who indicated he was going to spend millions of his own money. As you point out, President Bush is rejecting it again in this primary run, even though he says that he will accept the funding and the limits in the general election. But do you think that in his doing that, rejecting it in the primary run, he's in effect forcing the Democrats to do the same thing?
I'm not so sure it's a good idea for a Democrat to agree to spending limits when the president is going to be able to spend $200 million just in the primary election. It's not going to be a level playing field, and it's not going to be a fair election under those circumstances.
You, the biggest booster of campaign finance reform.
That's right, but the reality is presidential elections should be competitive. Both candidates, both the Democratic and Republican candidates, ought to have a level playing field. And under the present system, under the present rules, the Democratic candidate is going to be at a clear disadvantage because the president's going to have $200 million more than the Democratic candidate.
But what do you say to people who say, you know, that's the breaks. If the Republican Party has more individuals that they can collect from, that's the way the cookie crumbles.
Well, I think what we need to do as a country, and Senator McCain and I and Senator Feingold and Chris Shays have been working to come up with a bill to correct the problems with the publicly financing part of the Presidential Campaign Act. What we're looking to do is provide more money for those candidates who agree to spending limits so that they can spend more money and get more public money. The result would be that they'd be able to be competitive.
And it would be more of an incentive to do so.
There'd be more of an incentive. What's going to happen now is the reality is candidates do not have incentive to participate in the publicly financed presidential campaign system, which frankly worked very well for a number of years after Watergate. There just needs to be an adjustment. It needs to be an infusion of more money so that it be so candidates who raise private money can get, rather than getting $250 in public money for a private contribution, they can get $500 or $750. The result would be a candidate would be able to be competitive. I think most Americans would like to see cleaner elections, and secondly, they want fair elections. This election, under the present scenario, won't be fair.
Well, Congressman, thank you very much. Congressman Marty Meehan speaking to us from Boston, Massachusetts.
Just ahead, polling the president's popularity.
And later in the program, boutique health care. One hospital says it will subsidize the poor, but will richer patients get better health care?
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Some recent polls may not surprise anyone. A new New York Times poll reveals Republicans, more than Democrats, like golf and Christian radio, while Democrats, more than Republicans, find solace in tennis and listening to National Public Radio. But other recent polls are more noteworthy, about trends on the more important question of power and politics. The latest Pew Research poll shows President Bush's approval rating has dropped to where it was just before 9/11, to 53%, mirroring results in another wide-ranging poll by Zogby International. But we're joined now on the line by President and CEO of Zogby International, John Zogby, and welcome, John.
Thanks, Bill.
Well, John, first, before we get into any numbers, just to encapsulate, what does your midsummer poll, and these figures were released in mid-July, indicate about how Americans see the president right now?
They see him as they saw him just prior to 9/11. In fact, the amazing thing about this president and polling is that his numbers have been very much a bell-shaped curve since he entered the presidency in January of 2001.
Now, why is it that Americans are not as enamored of him as they once were?
President Bush has never really developed a majority governing constituency on domestic issues. In fact, when we take a look at his job performance on the economy, on health care, on education, the environment, and even for that matter on taxes, which is his flagship issue, what we find is that the American people are really not with him. He has a core of support, but what has thrust this presidency into the popularity that it has achieved on a few occasions has been 9/11 and then the war in Iraq. And then after a certain amount of time, his numbers subside and they go right back to basically 50-50.
So, John, what are the numbers? Give me some numbers. For example, how is he seen on terrorism? That's still positive, right?
That works for him. Yep, this president hovers around 60% positive on terrorism. That's his best number, that's as much a factor of three additional things. One is post 9/11 rallying around the president. Number two, that's a traditional Republican strong suit anyway. And then number three, the likability factor. Americans do like George W. Bush as a person. Give him good marks on leadership.
Maybe a little premature to talk about reelection, but let's talk about it anyway, because there are some startling numbers in your poll, right?
There really are. There are a couple of barometric readings that we always use. One is what we call in our business the reelect. Does the president deserve reelection, or is it time for someone new? For the first time since before 9/11, we see the president at a net negative. 46% say he deserves reelection. 47% say it's time for somebody new. And then when we measure him against really the only measurement we can use in a horse race, and that is the generic Democrat, we find that he's only leading by a few points.
Well, what about the Democrats? How are they doing, as your numbers indicate?
Interestingly, not terribly well. When we look at first of all, who is leading the pack? Really, no one is. In terms of the national Democrats, really, you still have Lieberman leading at about 12% or 13%. Everybody else in single digits, meaning, you know, essentially no one has really caught on as a front runner nationally. Different story, of course, in the two first battle states for next year, and that's Iowa, where Howard Dean, interestingly enough, now leads Dick Gephardt by a couple of points. And then, of course, in New Hampshire, where Dean, who leads by a few points in the most recent polls, is battling it out with John Kerry.
But Dean, at this point, despite being on the covers of two national magazines at the same time last week, still not a major conflagration around him, right?
No, you know, traditionally Democrats have had the front runner. And for years and years going back, it was Senator Edward Kennedy, for example, the one heavyweight Democrat who leads among traditional Democrat constituencies. There isn't that figure right now. Each of the leading Democratic candidates seems to have his own pocket of support, but no one is the 800-pound gorilla. You know, unless you put Al Gore in the mix, he's not running. Hillary Clinton in the race, and she's not running.
Close votes. The last presidential election was a close vote. Are we still in an essentially 50-50 nation?
Oh, I think we are. I think when you look at the domestic issues versus international issues, Democrats have some strength over Republicans. I think when you look at this presidency and see that despite two huge bumps that he receives from international events like 9/11 and then Iraq, that when it all settles down, as I mentioned at the top of the interview, it's a bell-shaped curve. He's still very much the 50-50 presidency that he was when he entered.
Well, if we're going to talk politics, and just to finish up, I can't let you go without mentioning California. Anything there that you can clear out from the underbrush that may indicate what's going to happen there in October?
Well, let's look at it in two pieces. You know, first of all is the recall effort. Right now, since Arnold Schwarzenegger entered the race, Gray Davis's numbers have actually gone down. So now about two out of three voters tell pollsters that they want to recall or remove Gray Davis. I wouldn't really count him out. He's a dogged fighter, and he knows how to go to the jugular. He also knows how to win in California. The issue will become more than just simply Gray Davis, the person. It will become an issue of stability and democracy. If you then assume that a recall will happen, you know, and there's 100, I guess at last count, now just a little over 200.
That's right.
Candidates will be on the ballot, then anyone could win with 15 or 18% of the vote. Right now you have to give that edge, obviously, to the Terminator.
John Zogby, we're going to terminate our conversation. Thanks very much for joining us today.
My pleasure, Bill.
John Zogby is president and CEO of Zogby International. He joined us from Lake Placid, New York.
There's more ahead, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community, on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, imagine an hour-long appointment and 24-hour cell phone access to your doctor. One hospital suggests concierge service for the rich to offset the cost of caring for the poor.
And our literary correspondent with his recommended narratives of cultural encounter, including John Steinbeck's A Russian Journal.
I'm going to read just a brief description that I think is the most down-to-earth, eloquent description of Russian bureaucracy that you're ever going to experience. He's just ordered a huge meal, his first meal in Russia, and it's taken 2.5 hours for it to be delivered to him.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Marianne Nichols. Liberian President Charles Taylor has bid farewell in a formal handover of power to his vice president, Moses Blah.
I leave you with these parting words. God willing, I will be back. God bless you.
Taylor, a former warlord, is blamed for 14 years of bloodshed in the West African nation. He used his resignation ceremony today to ask for help from neighboring African countries.
I hope that African countries will come in to the rescue of Liberia, because we in Africa believe that when your brother's house is on fire, you do not bring benzene, you bring water.
New President Moses Blah says Liberia has to work to regain the respect of the international community. Violence is easing in some parts of Iraq and flaring up in others. In northern Iraq, a U.S. soldier was killed and two others injured in a bomb attack. And in Basra, where British troops just restored power and gas, weekend protests left an Iraqi demonstrator and a Nepalese security guard dead. A Jewish settler accused of threatening Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon has just been released on the condition that he stay away from Jerusalem. Police say the 22-year-old, who lives in the Jewish outpost in Hebron, told officials, quote, "The Prime Minister killed my friend and my neighbor. It's no problem for me to kill him." Police haven't decided whether to file charges. California elections officials are sorting out the massive ballot for the October recall election. A random drawing is being held today to determine the order of names on the ballot. Lieutenant Governor Cruz Bustamante is one of nearly 200 candidates, although he says he does not want the recall effort to succeed.
Because there's two votes. People are going to have a chance to vote twice on this particular issue, on the recall and then somebody down ticket. And what I'm saying is that in the event that the recall doesn't work, I'm there just in case.
Bustamante made his remarks on NBC's Today show. Governor Gray Davis calls the recall election an insult to the voters who put him in office. Environmentalists are accusing President Bush of using fear of fire to gut environmental laws. The president is scheduled to survey a fire-ravaged community in Arizona today to promote rules that would allow logging in certain areas to reduce fuel for fires. On Wall Street at this hour, stocks are mixed. The Dow is down 25 points at 9166, NASDAQ up 10 at 1654.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
A sharp rise in the number of cases of West Nile virus around the country is sparking a series of warnings from public health officials. The Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta says the number of human infections tripled to 204 last week, and the number of deaths doubled. With at least another month and a half left in the peak West Nile season, that number is expected to rise even more. Joining us to discuss this year's outbreak is Dr. Roy Campbell, a medical officer with the CDC in Fort Collins, Colorado. Welcome, Dr. Campbell.
Thank you.
Well, Dr. Campbell, a sudden increase in infections. Colorado had a dozen cases last year. This year, it's already up to 166. Maine reported its first case of the year just this morning. What's going on?
Well, Colorado has some intense West Nile virus activity, much more intense than last year, and you're starting to see that reflected in human case reports. And in other parts of the country, you're starting to see West Nile virus heating up and being transmitted from mosquitoes to humans in an increasing rate.
But why?
Well, this time of year is typical for West Nile virus activity to increase. This is the traditional time, August and September.
But is the virus more virulent this year? Are there more mosquitoes? What do you think the reason is?
We don't believe the virus has changed, Bill. The weather changes in different places and different mosquito population changes are undergone. But the epidemic in 2002 in the United States was the largest epidemic of its kind ever described, with nearly 4,100 human disease cases and nearly 300 deaths. And so we're a little concerned that this year's numbers are very reminiscent of those numbers.
I see. So it's not so much that it's a major increase this year. It's just that something like this goes up and down from year to year.
That's right. And it goes up and down in different parts of the country.
So must we just concede the ground to this virus that year by year it will go up and down, but there's not much we can do about it?
There's a certain amount of this that is just going to be up to Mother Nature, to be honest with you. But there are many things that can be done by governments and by individuals. Organized mosquito control is very important. And if you live in an area where there is no organized government-sponsored mosquito control, then you should be in contact with your local leaders and politicians and working with them to establish long-term, sustained, well-funded mosquito control. Individuals have a strong role to play by eliminating mosquito habitat from around your home, cleaning up standing water. And then thirdly, repellents. There are at least a couple of good repellents that can be used by people to protect themselves and their family members. And wearing long sleeves and long pants and other protective clothing when you're in mosquito-infested environments is a good idea.
So here's a virus that appeared in 1999, only in 1999, that it appears is going to be with us for the foreseeable future. How concerned should an average person be?
Let me just say that, again, last year there were 4,100 human cases, and 3,000 of those were the serious brain infections, and about 300 people died. So to put that into perspective, it's not as dangerous as, say, not wearing your seatbelt on the freeway, or chronic smokers have a much higher rate of illness. But it's certainly not insignificant. And if you do get this virus and it does make its way into your brain, it can be a disaster. It's preventable. There are no treatments available once you get sick with it. If you get the mild West Nile fever, you'll do fine and you'll fully recover. But if it goes into your brain and your spinal cord, you could end up with permanent disability or death. So it's certainly something you want to try to prevent.
Dr. Roy Campbell, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Bill.
Dr. Roy Campbell is a medical officer with the CDC in Fort Collins, Colorado.
Well, for about 2 years, a small number of cash-strapped city hospitals have been trying out boutique care or concierge clinics, where those who can afford an annual fee receive more personal care from their doctors and hopefully offset the care of the poor. Tufts New England Medical Center in Boston is the latest teaching hospital to try out a concierge service with hour-long appointments and cell phone access to doctors, something a few private medical doctors have done for a while. Well, joining us on the line is Dr. Deeb Salem. He's overseeing the new clinic at Tufts New England Medical Center. It opens December 1st. And, Doctor, you know this may appeal immediately to a lot of people, but it also may seem really offensive to others because it seems to formalize a class system in the hospital.
We thought carefully about it, and it was our feeling that there are people that want this sort of service, and I think the tradition in hospitals, particularly teaching hospitals, if you go back hundreds of years, has been the people that have means have often been very generous towards using those means to help people that don't. And we see very clearly that the reimbursement for primary care does not even cover our costs, and we had to come up with something that would work and yet provide a good service to people that want it.
Well, some people would say time is care. The new amenities would include 30 to 60-minute appointments with a primary care doctor as opposed to 15-minute appointments, and 24 hours a day access to a doctor by cell phone. And some would say, shouldn't everybody get that?
Well, I wouldn't disagree. Just tell us how, if somebody
how to
can
do
give
it.
Us a way that we can do it. I'd be glad.
Your hospital is losing, I understand, $12.5 million on its operations last year, and it's hoped that the $1,800 per concierge patient fee would go a long way toward making up for the care that could then be given to poorer patients. How about the insurance coverage? We understand that in some places where this has been tried, it's run afoul of the insurance company's claim that anything that a hospital charges for can't be a service that's already covered by insurance.
We've checked carefully, and I think what we're doing is something that is an extra, and our attorneys and our managed care people feel that this works out for us.
Doctor, address one of the fears. It's always been assumed that a doctor would care for the sicker patient first. Does this mean that a doctor will care for the wealthier or the concierge patient before a poorer and possibly sicker patient?
No, absolutely not. I think that the way we're setting it up, first, the physician, unlike some of the other ways this is done, will not give up their other patients. Number two, we have it set up so when a physician is working, they're devoted to that area, but when they're not, someone else will be covering. So the coverage for their other patients will be handed off the way it normally is.
And we understand that the doctors will be able to do this because they'll be relieved of their teaching duties, which would be the only way they'd
right.
have the extra time.
Yeah, I think that they will not be involved in their teaching duties, so that will also make things a little more efficient for them.
Mm. We understand the new center is going to open in the former International Patient Center. Does this reflect as well that perhaps the international patients that used to flock to Boston hospitals and pay a lot of money for their health care aren't coming as much anymore?
Yes, I think that we are seeing that international patients, although they still come, are not coming in the same volume. And that created a void, and we're feeling that what we'll be doing will help fill it. But no, that's absolutely correct.
Mm. Well, Doctor, thank you.
Okay.
Dr. Deeb Salem overseeing the new Concierge Clinic at Tufts New England Medical Center, scheduled to open December 1st.
You're listening to Here and Now. On a typical balmy summer night in Harvard Square in Cambridge, Massachusetts, cafes crowd, iced teas are sipped amid the passing parade of street performers juggling and musicians jamming, and stores fill up, like the big bookstore of the Harvard Coop that oversees the square, where hundreds will be leafing through the latest lit or combing a classic or maybe trying to pick a birthday card. And it was from the card section at the Harvard Coop on a recent summer night that the following voice was heard.
Yeah, we're picking out a card for Bill. He's in New York.
The one voice first, then many, many more. Well, it's the sound of a fad that in one form or another has sounded off in cities across the globe. Flash mobs, the new pastime of, depending on your point of view, either the avant-garde cutting edge or maybe just trend addicts with a little bit too much time on their hands. A flash mob springs to life when an email or website declares a specific place will be the site of a strange, meaningless public happening for just a little while, after which the mob breaks up, leaving baffled observers agape. The mob in Harvard Square organized about 200 people to meet in the bookstore to ask store clerks for help finding a card for Bill, who lives in New York. The next step was to then begin cheering, In other cities, flash mobs have convened to make bird sounds or ask a Macy's salesperson for help finding a love rug. Well, radio producer Joe Ellen Easton witnessed the flash mob swarm at the Harvard Coop and talked to some of the mobsters about the experience.
What's your name?
My name's Hanny.
I'm just wondering, what did we just do?
Well, I was trying to get a card for a friend of mine, Bill. Okay. It's in New York. But I think everyone else had the same idea. A big part of it has to be where it's being done. I think Boston and New York are sort of big metropolitan areas, so that kind of spread pretty quickly. So.
Do you think the student population in Boston has anything to do with it?
Maybe.
You think?
Possibly.
My name is Courtney.
Based on the current security situation in the U.S. right now, I mean, I'm imagining that this probably makes security individuals kind of nervous.
Well, I would think so, because really, if you're going to do something nefarious, it is convenient to have 100 people or 200 people standing there with you who don't know what's going on. You know, you could conveniently call a flash mob to a bank and then rob the bank, but that's not what this is about. If security people are actually nervous, you know, they can show up. When people dissipate in less than 10 minutes, there's not a whole lot you can do in 10 minutes.
And did you notice that there were cops on every corner?
Oh, yes. Or? Yes. Cops and media people, cameras everywhere.
And do you think that this is rebellious in any way?
I don't think it's so much a rebellion thing as just kind of a neat thing. I actually think of it as a performance hack, because I'm from MIT, and the people being interviewed don't always have the words for it. They're like, it's performance art, but it's not actually very artistic. And it's kind of like theater, but it's not really theater, not even a little. But it's kind of like a hack, so a little bit. So that's how I think of it.
Our visit to a recent flash mobbing incident at Harvard Square in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
When cultures collide, the result can be catastrophic. You may have just learned this on a summer vacation. But as you may also know, and as many authors do know, colliding cultures can be pretty compelling. Take E.M. Forster's A Passage to India, the 1924 novel set during the height of British rule, which chronicles the complex friendship between an Indian doctor and an English teacher. Then there's Graham Greene's classic, The Quiet American, describing an intricate love triangle between a Brit, an American, and a Vietnamese woman during the French Indochina War. Literary correspondent Steve Allman is here with more suggestions for books in which cultures clash. And Steve, I can see why this would be appealing to you, because you like to see things, you know, banging up against each other to see what happens.
I am not going to bite on that, Robin, but I'm very glad to be here and very glad to talk about this. A lot of my favorite books are narratives of cultural encounter, would be the pretentious professorial way of putting it. And in fact, the tradition travels all the way back really to the origins of literature. It's a lot of what the Old Testament is about, after all. And the Iliad and the Odyssey, of course, are both cultural encounters. Odysseus, after all, is traveling around, running into the Cyclops and the Sun People and all these different cultures in the end. I'm going to take us a little bit further forward. The first thing I want to read is a wonderful and often overlooked book by John Steinbeck called A Russian Journal. He took a trip to Russia in 1948, just as the Iron Curtain was slamming shut, basically. And we have plenty of garbage floating around our heads about what the Soviet Union was like under communism and so forth. Steinbeck really spent a good number of months just with the Soviet people, documenting their everyday lives. And I'm going to read just a brief description that I think is the most down-to-earth, eloquent description of Russian bureaucracy that you're ever going to experience. He's just ordered a huge meal, his first meal in Russia, and it's taken 2.5 hours for it to be delivered to him. Here's why. Since everything in the Soviet Union, every transaction is under the state or under monopolies granted by the state, the bookkeeping system is enormous. Thus, the waiter, when he takes an order, writes it very carefully in a book. But he doesn't go then and request the food. He goes to the bookkeeper, who makes another entry concerning the food which has been ordered and issues a slip which goes to the kitchen. There, another entry is made and certain food is requested. When the food is finally issued, an entry of the food issued is also made out on a slip, which is given to the waiter, but he doesn't bring the food back to the table. He takes the slip to the bookkeeper, who makes another entry that such food as has been ordered has been issued, and gives another slip to the waiter, who then goes back to the kitchen and brings the food to the table, making a note in his book that the food which has been ordered, which has been entered, and which has been delivered is now finally on the table.
That's great. Yeah. John Steinbeck's A Russian Journal. And do I see photographs by Robert Capa?
Yes, thank you for mentioning that. In the tradition of other pieces of ethnography, like Let Us Now Praise Famous Men by James Agee, which has beautiful photographs by Walker Evans, a wonderful photographer named Robert Capa accompanied John Steinbeck, actually was the impetus for him to head over to Russia. And the book, which is out in paperback as a Penguin 20th Century classic, has these photos by Robert Capa.
So the idea is send someone on a journey, or go yourself if you're John Steinbeck, but send a character on a journey and see what happens.
Absolutely. Now, the other thing we have to bear in mind when we think about cultural encounter is that more and more of our world is really filled with refugees. This is the disease of sort of modern nomadism. We're constantly shuttling from one place to another. There's so much greater mobility than there ever has been. So you see, Graham Greene is certainly a foremost example of this. And I would just say on a side note that if you're going to read one Graham Greene novel, make it The Heart of the Matter, which is set in northern Africa. It's absolutely heartbreaking and beautiful. And the next book I want to recommend is a wonderful book that's now out in paperback called The Spirit Catches You and You Fall Down.
Yeah.
People may be a little bit familiar with it. It was the winner of the National Book Critics Circle Award. It's about the Hmong culture who are from Laos, and a great number of them ended up in Merced, California, in Northern California, a large immigrant population. And The Spirit Catches You and You Fall Down is really the story of one Hmong child who has severe epilepsy and the encounters that she has with the American medical system with tragic results, which I won't detail. But the book is an absolutely breathtaking exploration of what happens when two cultures who fundamentally don't see the body and medicine and healing in the same way crash into one another. I should mention it's by Anne Fadiman, a wonderful nonfiction writer. I'm just going to read a little portion that from the beginning that tries to articulate this cultural encounter problem. The Hmong have a phrase which means to speak of all kinds of things. It is often used at the beginning of an oral narrative as a way of reminding the listeners that the world is full of things that may not seem to be connected but actually are, that no event occurs in isolation, that you can miss a lot by sticking to the point, and that the storyteller is likely to be rather long-winded. I once heard Nau Khao Lee, that's the father of the little girl, begin a description of his village in Laos by saying, "It was where I was born, and where my father was born and died and was buried, and where my father's father died and was buried, but my father's father was born in China, and to tell you about that would take all night." If I were Hmong, I might feel that what happened when Leah Lee and her family encountered the American medical system could be understood fully only by beginning with the first beginning of the world. So she's trying to, I think, adumbrate the crisis of a culture whose traditions stretch back farther, really, than Western civilization, even. And it seems like, oh, gosh, how interesting is this going to be? It's, you know, about the medical system, but it's really about who the Hmong are, how they got to be who they are, and these well-meaning doctors' inability to really connect with them and, in this case, heal a little girl.
And The Spirit Catches You and You Fall Down, that refers to the epilepsy.
That would be the American way of looking at it. The Hmong have a different version. It's a spirit. It's not a medical condition. So, there's another book I want to sort of mention quickly, a couple more, actually. For those who are fans of fiction, a wonderful novel called Le Divorce by Diane Johnson from a couple of years ago. It's now been made into a motion picture. It is in the tradition of Henry James, who is another wonderful writer of cultural encounters, European and American. It is the story of a woman who goes over to France to take care of her stepsister's child and really, in some sense, has to oversee her sister's very messy divorce from a Frenchman. I'm just going to read a little portion from the beginning where the narrator, Isabel, is referring to her stepsister, Roxy. It goes without saying that she had her junior year abroad, though not in Paris and Aix-en-Provence. She loved it, though there were so many Americans there that she didn't make much progress speaking French. All the same, she came home with a pleased, slightly secret look, as if she dared not share with us her new experiences of goose liver and escargot and sex, which is what I imagine gave her this worldly satisfaction. Air, but it wasn't sex. It was her new ability to distinguish between Gothic and Romanesque and to read Paris Match that pleased her. Now she couldn't find food to suit her in Santa Barbara. This is something of a kind of comedy of manners. It's got a lighter touch.
So that's Le Divorce, which people might want to read before seeing the movie.
Well, only if they want to be really disappointed in the movie.
Which is usually the case, yes. Anyway, with good books. And all of these are about seeing a culture through another culture's eyes.
Yeah, and the last book I want to mention is an interesting twist on this, Robin. It's called Reading Lolita in Tehran, a memoir in books by Azar Nafisi. And this book, in some sense, it's really about a reading group, a book group, who read various Western books, obviously Lolita, but also Pride and Prejudice and other classics of Western literature in Tehran during the, let's call it the religious oligarchy, where it was forbidden to read these kind of books. And it's more or less the way in which they encounter Western culture and literature and art, for that matter, in their own culture. But it's a kind of literary clash of cultures.
You know, it's funny. That feels like it's almost a genre. When I hear Reading Lolita in Tehran, it reminds me of the Hemingway Book Club of Kosovo, which we covered here on Here and Now. Again, that idea of the books being the thing that bring the cultures together.
In a larger sense, that's what narratives of cultural encounter are about. It is the role of literature, in some sense, to try and make sense of the world around us, and especially in this age where we're constantly flinging off living or dealing with groups who have been forcibly or of their own volition moved to a foreign culture. Literature is trying to capture that, and that's why I think these books have that kind of resonance.
Mm. Well, Steve, thank you very much.
Thank you, Robin.
Here and Now's literary correspondent Steve Almond teaches creative writing at Emerson College. He's author of a book of short stories called My Life in Heavy Metal, and he's sort of Here and Now's one-man culture clash himself.
Do you really want to hurt me? Do you really want to make me I'm sorry, that's Culture Club, Robin, sorry.
For more information on Steve's books of cultural encounter, visit our website, here-now.org.
Oh, when you come crash into me, come into you, and I come into you, baby. In a boy's dream.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR, Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news and these stories. Here and Us next time for the news and these stories. Here and